This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. On behalf of Slot Foundation and the Department of Architecture, I welcome you back to Slot Foundation. This is the concluding event for the Evasions of Power Conference and Symposium. Many of you have been part of it, but for those that are just joining us for the first time, it's been a series of events that have explored the relationship between literature, geopolitics, and architecture. The various events that have taken place yesterday and today are being recorded, and they'll be available online. Today's event, this concluding event with Tom Levine, is called Tracking Tactics and Rhetorics. Thomas Levine on the vicissitudes of the panoptic from surveillance to data valence. And this is somewhat of an unusual event, and I'll explain why that is and how it's structured and how it's going to proceed. Tom has been here quite a few times, most recently, and I'll read his bio in just a minute. Most recently, he had curated a show right behind us in this small bank vault on the Situationist International and Guy Debord and his critical practice in the form of his films. And there had been a wonderful conversation that he and I had organized with Tony Vidler, Keith Sandbord, and himself. And so that's available online, and it's also available in one of our recent books in a transcript form. Today's session, like the ones that took place yesterday, is predicated on a close reading of an essay that Tom recently wrote. That essay is called Rhetoric of the Temporal Index, Surveillant Narration, and the Cinema of Real Time. This recently appeared in a publication that I can provide the reference for. This is available online as a download, so again, if you haven't already read it, I know it's been pre-circulated, I encourage you to do so. So Tom's a professor in the Department of German at Princeton University since 1990. He specializes in media, cultural theory, the Frankfurt School, art history, and acoustics and technics. In 1999, and I'm going to be very brief here, he's an incredibly accomplished friend and scholar. In 1999, Tom was chosen by the Dutch Ministry of Culture to be the artist in residence at the Witt de Witt Center for Contemporary Art in Rotterdam, where he developed a project entitled Celluloid Rembrandtiana that investigated the dynamics of cultural nationalism and mass media through a program of over a dozen films on Rembrandt. This traveled quite a bit, quite extensively, and most recently was at the Getty Museum in L.A. In 2000 and 2001, he was the academic director of the Berlin Consortium for German Studies at FU Berlin. And during that time, Tom studied the origins of synthetic sound in the late 1920s and theoretical issues posed by the advent of digital imaging. Most of you would probably be familiar with his curated exhibition Control Space, Rhetorics of Surveillance from Bentham to Big Brother, which was on display at the ZKM through 2002. Other projects related to the aesthetic politics of surveillance include Anxious Omniscience at the Princeton University Art Museum, 9/11 Plus One, the Perplexities of Security at Brown University's Watson Center. And in 2005, he organized a conference at the Louvre in Paris, which reexamined the history of the carceral image in the wake of Abu Ghraib. And Levine is recently working on a project about the film theoretical cinema of Guy Debord, which was kind of in a way the basis for the project with us here. So with that, I'm going to just introduce the other component of today's event. It's taking the form of a seminar of sorts by Tom, as well as a roundtable with the Goldsmiths members that have come here from London and from all over the world under the direction of A.L. Weitzman to my left. The Center for Architectural Research at Goldsmiths College brings together architects, urbanists, filmmakers, curators, and other cultural practitioners from around the world to work on expanded notions of architecture that engage with questions of culture, politics, conflict, and human rights. In keeping with their commitment to multidisciplinary research and learning, the Center offers an alternative to traditional postgraduate architectural education by inaugurating a combination of critical architectural research and practice-based research as a form of dissertation towards master's and PhD degrees. The aim of the center is to give rigorous tools for urban research and practice to a variety of practitioners from various backgrounds, again, many of whom are here today. And in this sense, it's a very practice-led theoretical project. So the participants pursue individual projects, undertake research and writing, all of which incorporate critical theory, philosophy, and cultural studies. So it's an honor to welcome them all here today, and they will make a series of informal and formal remarks following Tom's presentation. So with that, Tom Levine.
Let's go. Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Aaron, and the slot crew for making it all work. What I'm going to talk about today, in a certain sense, is going to revisit the number of the questions of the essay that was circulated, looking at some questions around pop culture and the legibility of, or what we could call surveillant legibilities. There are really two contexts, I think, that are important to keep in mind in understanding why it makes sense or what might be at stake in a kind of aesthetico-political analysis of surveillance. On the one hand, as any of us who travel know all too well, when we go to airports, we go through these security spaces. It's very clear to anybody who has looked carefully at what goes on there and who reads about the incredible number of accidental butcher knives that people discovered were in their carry-on luggage after they got home, that this is not about a really rigorous security examination. This is what one could call a kind of theatrics of power, a theatrics of security. And thus, the question of mise-en-scène, the question of the performance, the question of a kind of eventhood of surveillance and security is one that, in a certain sense, is all too central to contemporary understandings of this phenomenon. Secondly, however, the question of the representation of surveillance, and in particular, I'm going to be looking at cinematic representations of surveillance, pop cultural representations of surveillance, is of particular interest at this historical juncture precisely because the state of the art of surveillance, as all of you, I take it, know, but it's worth repeating nevertheless, is not of the order of the phenomenal. Data surveillance, which is in a certain sense where surveillance is happening today, is pervasive, and yet not something that is easily representable. Video surveillance, even the representation of audio surveillance, I'm doing a project with some students on The Wire right now. If we have time, we can look at some instances from that later, are in that regard deliciously anachronistic, but potentially very useful as a displacement into the domain of the phenomenal, into the legible of issues that, in a certain sense today, are taking place in a domain that it largely exceeds or is not available to the phenomenal. I couldn't help but begin with a few images of the iconography of surveillance that we're, in a certain sense, most familiar with, whether it's these images of the day before 9/11, one of the 9/11 terrorists in a Walmart, or the epidemic for the Goldsmith folks, a little bit of nostalgic familiarity, posters all over London, or the UK in general, but London in particular, of the kind of inhabitation of quotidian spaces by the fact of CCTV or closed-circuit television. But of course, there's a kind, what we could say, a kind of pop cultural recasting of CCTV going on. And it's no longer of the order of the classically panoptic of the sort you saw this morning. I just thought I would just show you one of the cinematic, grand cinematic representations of a kind of carceral space of the sort that, for those of you who went to the Eastern State this morning, saw. And that's, can we just check the sound on the computer, please? This is Jimmy Stewart walking the ramparts of the Stateville Penitentiary in Indiana, a grand, multi-tiered, panoptic classic. This literally thematic mise-en-scène...
He must run a nice jail. This guy doesn't want to get out either.
...use of surveillance as a site for...
I'm going to get this out of my system if I never write another line.
Is there a way we can kill this light, which is washing out the
scene? Do you think we check and talk to me again?
Yeah, I imagine
really
he would.
A pity.
I'll take you over to the hospital. He works there.
You know, if the marvelous. If this as a kind of figure for a certain logic of panoptic space, if this can be understood as a certain economy of the panoptic, in a certain sense, it marks a huge difference from this economy of what one could call a kind of surveillant narcissism. Far from being anxious about this, the possibility of the gaze, here the gaze becomes a place, an opportunity for a kind of performativity, a kind of quotidian narcissistic fabulousness. And this is, in a certain sense, characteristic of the epidemic of surveillant iconography in pop culture, whether it's the recasting of literary classics, as in this cartoon, in surveillant terms, late at night reviewing his surveillance videos, Dr. Frankenstein began to understand what lay behind the recent incidents in the laboratory, or Christmas cards, Santa Clausian panopticism, to pop cultural fashionista surveillance hipsterdom. Clearly, the question of the surveillance has jettisoned, at least in part, its ominous big brotherian resonances for a very different kind of appeal. Any presentation, I think, ought to begin, I think, with a question. So in a sense, the question I'd like to pose to you today is, no! Why is Dennis Hopper screaming? What's at stake in this scream? In case you didn't hear it, it wasn't very loud. Let me pump up the volume. No! Okay. Maybe he's screaming because of this.
The meeting was frank. 53%. More news in a moment. It's a matter of money. That's all for tonight. It could take months.
What you're seeing here is an example of synthetic video. This is a project at MIT where a woman was filmed and in which they sampled basically every possible phonemic piece such that they could then put together sequences, video sequences of her saying basically anything they wanted.
The fire is being allowed to burn itself out. He tossed in 31 points and 11 assists.
If you look carefully at the mouth, you get a sense of
warmer temperatures are predicted in some areas.
It's the slight strangeness. But what's barely visible here, or visible only once one has it pointed out, is perhaps a bit more readable here in this installation by the Belgian video artist David Clairbout. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but Clairbout takes, in this case, for example, an early turn-of-the-century vintage photograph and submits it to a kind of digital post-production in that, as you can see here, the only thing that is moving in this bucolic Dutch landscape are the leaves of the tree, which he insists he's gone back to find this famous tree, which was known because of its kind of Chernobylian voluptuousness, and filmed the tree whose leaves we see barely moving in the wind. Now, this introduction of a kind of digital intervention into the still images raises all kinds of questions about the status of the image. Is it a still image? Is it a film? We go and scan the image for further evidence of its semiotic identity, and it raises a kind of anxiety. Here you see the installation of this large room-size image. But if it's what's here readable in a very subtle fashion, provoking a scream, is more joyously foregrounded in a video like this, which you may know by Paul Pfeiffer. a kind of fascinating artisanality of digital erasure. I don't know if it's readable, but this is called Stanley Cup. And Pfeiffer laboriously intervenes into the image. And if you look very carefully, you could actually see something like the shadow of the erased. And this kind of artisanality of erasure is and thus a foregrounding of present absence is enormously interesting. And part of the fascination, I would argue, is the quality of the image and the question of the image that intervention raises. Here, I'll show you another one. This is a Rumble in the Jungle, famous boxing match, where, I don't know if you can tell, but you see something like almost the halo of an erased presence. Can you see these very subtle interventions? A more pop cultural version of this intervention, or this readable intervention, a kind of joyous variant, is, however, perhaps seen here. Mixing board, of course. Beautiful, beautiful piece of work. What's at stake here, I think, is perhaps most readily illustrated in a Michel Gondry video that he did for Kylie Minogue. I'm sure some of you have seen this video, Come Into My World, an intolerable piece of self-indulgent narcissism, but deeply symptomatic media theoretically. For those of you who haven't seen it recently or don't have it in memory, the structure of the video is basically Kylie walking around a block, but each time she returns to this site where the video begins, another Kylie appears, and the third time around, a third Kylie. And what's interesting is, and I'll show you a clip from it in a moment, is to look at the really fascinating contrast between the foregrounded digital post-production multiplicity of Kylies engaged in a complex choreography with each other, and a profilmic multiplicity in the background. Because in the background of the space that these multiple Kylies are traversing, you have first one of each of a waiter, poster, somebody putting up a poster, et cetera, and each time around, there's another until by the end, the space in which the digital post-production is taking place is itself massively saturated with non-digitally produced post-production multiplicity as well. Let's take a look at it. The only response to that is, if digital compositing violates the supposed integrity of the image field of the photograph or of the video, it marks, in a sense, the collapse into one image of two oppositional categories very central to 18th century aesthetics. I'm thinking here of those categories that Lessing articulated in the famous canonical text, the Laocoon, of, on the one hand, das Nacheinander, the sequential, which is to say of the order of the narrative, that which follows one after another, and das Nebeneinander, the simultaneous, that which is side by side. Because what happens here is that these two seeming key oppositional categories of a major aesthetic paradigm are effectively collapsed into one. Because what you see, and I'll give you a marvelously delicious example, and that's Eddie Murphy in The Nutty Professor, where Eddie Murphy plays every single one of the adults sitting around the table in this film.
Good to see you, sir.
Now, I'm going to turn down the sound because it's so unbelievably hilarious that you won't pay any attention to me. But what's important here is that with the exception of the little kid, the mom, the grandmother, the grandfather, Eddie Murphy and his muscly brother, Nutty Professor and his muscly brother, are all played by Eddie Murphy, which is to say, what looks like a scene of simultaneity, people sitting next to each other, we know, in terms of the condition of possibility of the production, had to have been produced sequentially, right? So that this seeming spectacle of temporal homogeneity is in fact racked by, striated by, multiple temporal zones. It is an example of what I call the heterochronic image. Right? And this heterochrony is, in a sense, subtly visible here. That is, it's visible only to the extent that you recognize, and the conceit of the movie is this incredible thespian tour de force of Eddie Murphy playing all these characters. In a sense, without that knowledge, its heterochronicity is not readable in the same way. Compare that to an earlier instance of a kind of optical compositing, and that's Who's Afraid of Roger Rabbit, where the heterochronicity here is foregrounded in terms of the contrast between the live action and the animation. This is not yet digital compositing. This is still of the order of optical compositing, a kind of artisanal precursor.
Oh, excuse me.
So, now, let's compare this to a piece of another video that Gondry did for the Chemical Brothers, in which this highly legible contrast between optical compositing, live action, and animation becomes itself, in a sense, the game of the video. The legibility of the heterochronic or not is at stake here. So look, what you see here, on the one hand, a kind of prismatics of multiplicity, but here, that prismatics is profilment, right? So it looks like a digital compositing. In fact, this is a series of similarly, women who look very much the same, but these alternate with various other forms of prismatic multiplicity where we do have a different kind, or the issue of readable or non-readable multiplicity is foregrounded. But in a sense, the question of the theoretical stakes involved here are best captured by yet another video, and this one, of course, by Outkast. The singers are gray, the guitarists, the keyboardists are all gray. This is a key moment. For a moment, what we have here. In a sense, what this video stages is a confrontation of a kind of foregrounded heterochronicity, Love Below Band, played where every single one of the musicians is Dre himself, with two very explicit, foregrounded, intermedial references. On the one hand, the Polaroid, clear, and on the other, I hope you noticed, early black and white television. Why early television? Well, in a sense, it's key. So here we have the Polaroid. Polaroid. What's at stake in insisting on both the Polaroid, whose condition of possibility is instant development, right, as well as television, is that both, in a sense, could be argued to be in different, slightly different and subtly different ways, figures of real time, right? Early television, as you know, was broadcast live, right? Now, what we see here, and I want to suggest, is something like the confrontation or the relation of the anxiety, of an anxiety around the heterochronic, or at least the potentially heterochronic digital image. Because what is post-factum, the possibility of post-factum revision in the digital image, but the possibility that, in fact, unlike the photograph, you press the button, we do the rest, unlike a certain myth of the photograph, whose instantaneity guarantees a certain indexical verifiability, or viability, here the digital production represents the possibility of post-factum intervention in that field, which is to say multiple temporalities names the possibility of revision, right? Now, needless to say, this is something that has always already been a possibility within the history of photography from the beginning. The history of political photography only confirms that. This only makes more readily and quickly available what was always already a possibility in the photochemical as well. But in any case, here, this possibility of digital post-production of the heterochronic is confronted with two forms of what one could call semiotic compensation. Semiotic compensation for that loss, supposed loss of indexicality that the age of Photoshop represents, both of which are articulated in terms of temporality. That is, the instant Polaroid and the live televisual. This, I hope, in a sense, points to the argument that the essay that I gave you tries to make. That is, that, just to rehearse quickly the key move, counter to claims by certain media theorists that the development of the digital represents the end of the indexical, I insist that rather than the indexical being threatened by the digital, instead what we must recognize is that what happens in the age of the Photoshop is that the indexical shifts to the domain of the temporal, so that all the claims previously made by photochemical indexicality, because of the instantaneity and semiotic homogeneity of the photochemical field, the lack of agency in the intervention, unlike the painting, et cetera, are now guaranteed by the instantaneity of the real-time live image. Real-time, instant, live, these all name temporal economies which, as such, seem qua temporal instantaneity to make the same guarantees, and it's a rhetoric of indexicality, as the previous one was a rhetoric as well, to make the same kind of promises of non-intervention, lack of post-production manipulation, et cetera, that was previously the characteristic of the photochemical to cool. So, it's not surprising that we see as a result a proliferation of rhetorics of real time in mass culture, precisely where the notion of authenticity, of compelling spectacle, et cetera, is at stake. Whether it's here in this reality TV quartet of Heineken reality TV ads, or here in the insistence that the Truman Show is, as you see at the top of the billboard, live, or here in the studio of the Truman Show, no better way to insist on the real-time image than, as we learned from the War of the Worlds, for those of you who know this astonishing radio broadcast, no better way to produce an effect of authenticity or of real-time or of instantaneity than to interrupt it. Right, so this is the moment in the Truman Show when it goes off the air, but that's precisely the exception that proves the rule. Liveness is, in a certain sense, the key to understanding the particular spectacle which is the Truman Show. And here we have just
1.7 billion were there for his birth. 220 countries tuned in for his first step. The world stood still for that stolen kiss. And as he grew, so did the technology. An entire human life recorded on an intricate network of hidden cameras and broadcast live and unedited 24 hours
live
a day,
unedited,
7 days a week,
phrase,
to
right?
an audience around the globe. Coming to you now from Sea Haven Island, enclosed in the largest studio ever constructed, and along with the Great Wall of China, one of only two man-made structures visible from space. Now,
the
in
space
its 30th
surveillance
reality. Year, it's the Truman Show!
What a week it's been. I don't know about you, I was on pins and needles.
Okay, me too. There's been, as I'm sure you're aware, a kind of proliferation epidemic of filmic and televisual mass cultural appropriations of surveillance. Whether they are foregroundedly thematic, as in this remake, I'm just going to show you the credit sequence of Enemy of the State, which is, as you know, a remake of that ur-surveillance film, which I did a little reading of in this essay, the Coppola's 1974 Enemy of the State, The Conversation, also with Gene Hackman. This is the remake in the age of GPS, thermal imaging, et cetera. Look at this catalog of surveillance visual economies, whether they're heat thermal imaging, night vision cameras, images taken from compilations of actual surveillance. This, an image from the film we are about to see. These are actual bank robbery surveillance photos. Many of the images marked with a sound that is post-synced, or images going backward to insist on the status of the inscription as fake. Notice also how the image will change its quality dramatically when the credit for the director and producer come up. Having witnessed this relentless pace of a juxtaposition of high-speed montages, of very grainy, low-res images, and an aesthetics or authenticity of low-res, is something we can talk about later if you like, when the directorial credit comes up, suddenly the image will be calm, saturated, 35 millimeter celluloid, grand image quality. The fantasy of this film is the GPS satellite imaging fantasy. Remember the fat guy, pizza-eating guy, who, whenever they ask him for an image from the satellite, directed by Tony Scott, well, you can't see it on the shitty projector, but it's a beautiful, solid image. Then we go to this white noise, and now we're in the space of the narrative, right? That's just the opening credits. I just want to finish this thought about the fantasy of this film's tracking imaginary, and that is, whenever they ask him for an image of somebody on the ground, wherever they need to find them, the answer of the surveillance operator is always, it's already done, right? It's instantaneous. It's right away. That's the wet dream of satellite imaging. What's more interesting is when surveillance pops up in the most unexpected places. Now, one of the great advantages of the annoying fact that I have to travel a lot is that you get, when you sit on planes, to see all kinds of films that you might not otherwise have seen. And I was recently on a plane and watched, and this is when you take 12-hour flights to Brazil, a few films come in really handy. So I was watching this rather inconsequential film called Failure to Launch, the Jessica Sarah Parker vehicle. Sarah Jessica Parker vehicle. You may know about an older man who refuses to move out from his parents' house, and they hire Sarah Jessica Parker to basically seduce him into falling in love with her so that he will move out. But he finds out that she was in fact hired to do, they fall in love, actually fall in love, but then he finds out that she was hired to do so, and so what seems to be the first real relationship that he's had explodes, and it's a disaster, and she's going to move back to the West Coast, and he's devastated. Anyway, on the way to the airport, as one of the girlfriends is taking her to the airport, they decide to drop her by one of the friend's apartments in which she's left a piece of clothing. And we're going to see a scene now in which they lock her into this space, which is going to become a reconciliation scene. But I want you to watch now how this reconciliation scene gets articulated.
Why? Wait, what are you guys doing?
There's in a sense, no surveillance involved in this film, right? I mean, unlike Enemy of the State, The Conversation, where surveillance is an explicitly foregrounded thematic concern, here, this is just a melodrama.
Sorry. I tried to do it fast so it wouldn't hurt.
Traditional narrative treatment. Shot.
It's a refreshing change of pace.
Listen, I say there's no downside.
Here are the friends.
They already hate each other.
Who have now set up this encounter. And they're sitting down in a cafe. But the guy in the white t-shirt is a computer nerd. And as he's going to explain in a moment, he's set up a bunch of webcams in this space.
The note says, hi, we need to talk.
Yeah, I wrote that. Right after I tied myself to the chair and covered my mouth with duct tape.
So you don't want to talk?
To you? I'll pass.
Now we're going to begin to see...
I can't see your face. Do you have any other angles?
Parallel...
Foresight angles. Check it out. I installed 27 cameras that cover every inch of the apartment.
Were these up last night?
Yeah. No.
Ow.
I help tie the knots.
What we have here is
the... It's called an anchor hitch.
I could get out of those ropes.
Of diegetic surveillant spectators, right?
Well, this
surveillance
is ridiculous.
Becomes
not
a
to
means
mention
for
juvenile. We can't
the production
just sit here and not say
of a,
anything.
Of a spectacle within the space of the story... Within
right,
the diegesis.
I'll start.
Which is the spectacle that we are, as it were, witnessing. Right? So, questions about the construction of a spectatorial position as already always, at some level, also a surveillance position.
We should have done the flowers.
Oh, wait. She's going to say something.
Trip, I apologize. My job was manipulative
and what you're going to notice, and I don't know how much we can stand to watch this, but as the scene progresses,
but I never got the chance because you found out first.
The unmarked narration is going to increasingly come to alternate with and indeed become synonymous with the diegetic spectator, the diegetic surveillant spectatorship.
Sorry.
Let's just watch a little bit more.
Apology accepted.
Thank you.
What I'm using this example to try to
say anything?
No, I do.
Propose is what I call the becoming narration of surveillance.
Before me. I'm just asking because, you know, maybe we could all get together.
Surveillance, the diegetic surveillance spectatorship increasingly is synonymous with our spectatorial position.
Like the Chinese.
Wow, somebody's a little cranky today.
Trip. Your mother was still making you pancakes for breakfast.
The sound, and it's not as sound if I match walked into your across life the cut undid. From your the surveillance image to me. The frame narration.
Your life was in an extended stall pattern.
I wish I could talk to guys like that.
Well, it's easier when the guy's tied up.
No, I've talked to guys tied up before.
You want to talk about my life? What about your life?
Maybe
I shouldn't judge. I'm sure there's some reason that you turned out to be a soul-sucking Labrador retriever-killing harpy.
I don't get it. How does the dog fit into it?
Notice how the audience is now increasing. There's a kind of contagion of the lure of surveillance spectacle.
I was doing fine before you showed up. All right, I was having fun.
Oh, and I just ruined everything. So is that why you tried to break up with me? Or actually, you didn't. You just trotted out your parents so that I would have to break up with you.
Oh, snap! Oh,
that got his attention.
That's right, you call her.
And now, it's gone on the big screen, right? Now we're into the full-blown, diegetic, cinematic.
Why would you do that?
Mise-en-scène of the diegesis itself.
You gave me the look.
Not the look.
Why are you bringing up the look?
What's the look?
The look
it's a film
says,
theoretical
hey,
category.
I like you.
Oh, wow.
Okay, we can. You get the idea, right?
That must have been
horrible. Let's now look at the classic example, which is, of course, just to compare this remarkable scene, which I talk about in the essay. But for those of you who haven't seen it, I want you to see it again. Which is the final scene in Coppola's The Conversation, right? You remember our Harry Call, the hero of this film, is a private investigator who does primarily acoustic surveillance, and he's been shocked to find out at home as he's playing his saxophone to a gramophone record, an interesting relationship of the live performance to the pre-recorded, that through a telephone call that he gets, in which is played back what he's just played, that there's a bug in his space. So he's determined to find out where this bug is. We've learned over the course of the narrative that he's a deeply religious man, so the fact that he's willing to smash this religious icon as a devout Catholic is itself an index of the insanity that his paranoia is producing. Here we have a really interesting surveillance flashback, kind of to the scene, which is in a certain sense. Huh? You want it louder? Yeah, can we just kill these lights? Can we kill them? What? I don't need any light. Yeah. If you could just kill these, that would be all. Now look at, this is this key scene, right? This is the key. Much better, much better. So here's the icon. Pay attention to the sound because the acoustic is actually a very interesting key we can talk about later. So he smashes the icon. Is there something inside? Is there a bug inside? No. And now this theme of a kind of anxious piano tremolo. So he can't find it. If anybody can find this bug, he could. And it's somehow not to be found. This is the scene of the couple that he's been trying to understand throughout the entire film. And now this is the final shot. I don't know if you can tell. It's a high-angle shot, beginning a pan from right to left. We don't yet see where the source of the sax is. Now, in fact, in this shadow there is Harry Call playing his sax to a piano accompaniment that is, in a certain sense, nowhere, right? And then the image, the camera, having panned left, stops and pans right again. Very slowly and deliberately, at a very regular pace. Again, having reached a certain moment to the right, it reverses direction and goes back. Right? So the structure of this final shot is basically like this. If I were to do it in fast forward, I take it the formal invocation of a kind of surveillant back and forth panning is clear, right? So when I teach this film, I ask my students, well, so where's the device? And somebody would say, well, it's, you know, must be up in the ceiling. I say, come on. He's a surveillance pro, right? If anybody could find this damn surveillance device, he could. Why can't he find it? Because it's not in the space, not in within the space of the diegesis, the space in which that he's taking it apart to try to find it. It's the very condition of possibility of that space. In other words, the surveillance, far from being something located in the diegesis, has become the characteristic of the very condition of possibility of the diegesis, which is to say, it is the narration itself. Surveillance has migrated into the narrative enunciation, and thus can't be found, right? What better way to insist on the urgency of paranoia, precisely because it is, in a certain sense, it constructs, the surveillance condition constructs the very world that he lives in. Now, just to give you a sense of the various narrative possibilities that certain kinds of surveillance afford, let's look for a moment at another classic example.
Hey, well, I just waltzed on in there and I said,
Thelma and Louise.
Their head,
this is
head.
What's called
Thelma says, y'all lie down on the
a surveillance flashback, right? She is narrating this enacted flashback.
Sir, would you do the honors? Take all the cash out of it and I'll put it in paper bag.
The
yes, ma'am.
Sync sound of the surveillance
friends.
Tape.
Not you'll have a tag on
but
your toe.
You here, we're right. Somewhere else at the same time.
Ma'am, would you be quiet? Sir, sit down, please. Thank you. Just stay there. Just get real comfortable.
So hey, now we're watching the surveillance tape, thus putting ourselves in the position of these surveillance spectators, which is to say the husband and various police officers, at a time relative to the frame narrative from which this flashback began, that is later, and then we see the insistence on the materiality of the signifier, the surveillance
as tape,
and we're back into the frame. So, is the complex temporal sequence that this particular surveillance tape proposes clear? They're sitting in the car. She says, "Well, what just happened? She's just come out and having robbed the store." And she said, "Well, I just walked on in there and cut." Now we see the surveillance tape image, and it's functioning as a enacted flashback or enacted mise-en-scène of the immediate past. Are you with me? But then, as that is running, we cut to this other group of spectators who are watching it at a time in the narrative future, right? Subsequent to their immediate escape from this robbery, this tape is then found and watched by police at another location. This possibility for a kind of temporal disjunction is in fact afforded by the status of the surveillance here as tape. Compare that to a very different condition, which is this surveillance logic of Mike Figgis's remarkable work, Time Code. I take it many of you have seen this film. For those of you not familiar with it, you know, the condition of its production is four digital cameras start at exactly the same time and run in each of these quadrants for 90 minutes of continuous time. And the relative, our attention is directed to the different quadrants by the sound editing, which foregrounds the sound in whatever is the narrationally salient quadrant at the time. On the DVD, interestingly enough, you can remix the sound yourself. And indeed, Figgis, when he showed the film at festivals, would do a live mix of the sound. Now, the relations between these different quadrants are articulated both visually. You sometimes see the same scene, as you may have noticed in the bottom, from two perspectives, thus allowing you to understand the simultaneity of these cameras. People talk across the quadrants and cell phones and various others. But there's a remarkable way in which the film uses the conceit. It's a film shot in Southern California.
Joey Z
has a certain proclivity to earthquakes. And every once in a while, an earthquake happens, with the result that the image shakes. This, what Werner Hamacher so wonderfully called das Beben der Darstellung, the quaking of the signifier, of representation. In a certain sense, like the Polaroid image in the Outcast video, you shake it. And the shaking of this image is what precisely allows you to figure visually the temporal signature, simultaneity, which governs the relation between the quadrants. Now, just so that it's clear that... And here, just to remind you, here are our Polaroids. Just so that the question of the legibility, of surveillance legibility, is not only something that is taking place in a pop cultural idiom, I just want to make a short excursion and show you one or two or three projects which invoke surveillance legibility in a slightly different sense. This is a remarkable installation by a young Dutch artist, Ginny Voss, who inhabited the entirety of the Stedelijk in Eindhoven with a series of large wooden monochrome sculptures. You can get a sense of the scale. You can see the doors up above or here with these people. But the genius of these monochrome installations well, it only became visible when, upon leaving the exhibit, you walked by the usually closed door of the security office where the guards sit. And it was there that you saw this, revealing these sculptures as a kind of anamorphic writing for the extant dispositif, the extant installed surveillance system. If you then went back and started looking at these, as it were, from the position of the new intelligibility that this witnessing of the surveillance booth has given you, you, in a certain sense, have to internalize a surveillant gaze in order to recognize their anamorphic, recognize these structures as an anamorphic inscription. Right, and there you see the surveillance camera above. So a writing for, a legibility for a surveillant mise-en-scène. Contrast this with this installation by Anne-Sophie Siden, a Swedish artist, called Station 10 and Back Again, which, as the iconography around these 18 DVD monitors makes clear, is a mise-en-scène of the life of the fireman. Now, that itself is already a film historical reference. The Life of an American Fireman is, in a sense, the most famous instance of a genre that proliferates in early cinema, and that is fireman films. Why would there be a lot of fireman films in early cinema? Well, think about it. You have to deliver films as quickly and as cheaply as possible to your company. One easy way of doing so is you go stand by the firehouse, wait till the bell rings, start cranking, the horse comes out with a fire truck behind it, you follow cranking to the fire, you crank some more as the flames are doused, the damsel is rescued, you crank some more as the firemen go home, the door of the firehouse closes, you continue to crank. Beginning, middle, end, drama, costumes, excitement, closure, microdrama, finished, right? That temporality of eventhood, classic narrative eventhood, is in fact precisely what is absent here. What Seiden's installation catalogs is everything but the excitement of going out and putting out fires or whatever it is that firemen do. Thus, what do we see on these monitors? Playing ping pong, doing the laundry, cooking, cleaning, sleeping, washing. That extension of time, duration as spectacle, that is in fact what marks most of the time the life of the fireman. But this recalibration of eventhood, this looking at a notion of extension as itself a form of spectacle, that is precisely the signature of surveillance. Right? What surveillance marks, in fact, if you look at surveillance images, is not the kind of event that most of the time, even in its mass cultural appropriation, surveillance is used to deliver. Note, for example, the melodrama reconciliation scene that we saw in Failure to Launch. No, most of the time, very little happens in surveillance. And as a result of that very little, when you start watching, and the paradigmatic instance of this is a very important film, 1983 film by a German filmmaker named Michael Klia, called The Giant, which was an 80-minute compilation of images mostly from surveillance cameras. Also a series of other kinds of tracking images. But what happens when you watch these surveillance images is that you suddenly find yourself completely recalibrating what is the minimum condition of an event. So when you see a sailboat slowly tacking towards the shore and then finally it does a virage and goes back out, that becomes virtually pornographic in its climax. And is a really powerful evidence of precisely how a new economy of eventhood is being put into place. Finally, an installation that some of you may have seen at the Dia and Beacon. This is from an installation of the same multi-screen video installation at the Centre Pompidou in Paris recently. This is Bruce Nauman's installation, Mapping the Studio. Subtitle Fat Chance John Cage. What we see here is a series of very long, seemingly still set of video projections from night vision cameras of the artist's studio, at site of agency, of production, et cetera, et cetera. But this is precisely where Nauman is absent. And most of the time, nothing happens, or very little happens. Every once in a while, a moth will go across the image, or a cat will scurry across chasing a mouse that you've seen go across in another image. And that begins to become another instance of this mise-en-scène of kind of recalibration of eventhood, a legibility of a different sort. We can talk more at length if you like about this installation, because it does a series of moves by color coding the different images, inverting them in an almost with the kind of formalism of a dodecaphonic a composition. But nevertheless, this notion of and the reference to John Cage invokes precisely that economy of observation that Cage's famous 4 minutes and 23 seconds piece insists upon. That is, no need to produce new objects, new compositions. It suffices to attend differently. Let me end now, because I promised you that I would talk about, or at least answer the question. Here's an example of the cat going across the screen. In that regard, this is a totally unrepresentative image for this installation, which most of the time has very little going on. But I promised you I would say something about the scream. And for those of you film buffs, you probably recognize the scream from Speed. Now, you recall this Keanu Reeves vehicle in which, let me just set up the situation for those of you who haven't seen it recently. There's a bus that's been rigged with a bomb by a disgruntled former cop, and if the bus goes below a certain speed, the bomb will explode. In order to minimize the collateral damage of this bus, which is in the middle of town, when they discover this, they've driven the bus out to an airport, and it's circling the perimeter of the airport, and they're trying to figure out how to get people off the bus. So they suddenly realize somehow this bad guy who's in touch with them through telephony can see or knows what they're doing, so they can't simply take the people off the bus because he somehow has some ability... hint, surveillance, to track this. Well, we're now going to join Keanu Reeves on the bus as he discovers how exactly this is being done.
Wildcat.
Right?
He can see you.
He can see you.
What?
He can see you. Can see Just me. Keep looking straight ahead.
There it is. The wireless video surveillance cam.
He called you a wildcat before I didn't even pick up on it. The bastard's got a camera right in your face. He can see the whole bus. He's been playing me from minute one.
Yeah, well, he can see me, but can he hear me?
Doesn't look like he's just watching.
Now we cut to the actual watching. Pan out. Cross. There he is, watching other simultaneously other screens, which are marked live.
Driver of another bus, both blown up by the bomber, and the other people in jeopardy are, of course, the passengers of the bus, held hostage at the whim of a madman. Now, if you've been with us, you've seen the bus.
The whim of a madman.
So
I like that.
They have an idea. What can we do? Well, what they're going to do is basically jack into the signal. They're going to take the signal from the... find the signal that the surveillance camera is broadcasting, tape it, make a loop, and broadcast the loop instead of the live signal. Let's take a look. Here's the plan.
There's a camera on the bus just over my left shoulder. I want you to stare straight ahead. Don't make any big movements. Okay? It's Jack. Yeah, I know about Harry. Is that news van still around?
Get those cameras to stop taping.
Right. LAPD, I need this unit. Now, you can broadcast UHF, right?
Yeah, sure.
There's a signal going to that bus. I want you to find it.
Emergency situation here. We're going to have to take you off the air temporarily.
Yeah, sure.
Please, sir, stop taping.
Come on, hurry up. Good, tape off of that. Remember, no big movements.
Okay, so
just look with.
They've caught the signal.
That ain't gonna be
too hard. Now they're gonna start taping.
Tape it, good, come on, tape it.
It's taping.
Jack, 5 minutes.
Not enough time. Run the tape. We have to unload.
I only have a minute of tape.
Do it now.
I want you to make a tape and loop it so that it runs over and over, okay? All right, run it. Run it!
All right, tape's rolling.
Okay, so now, having replaced the live feed with the recorded feed...
That everyone is safe for the moment.
This is it's a danger when you go to have a pee. Miss key moments, semiotic differentiation. So now we're at a moment when having...
Bears Jackie could have made a good cop.
Thinking that he's basically made it because they're unable to get the people off the bus, he suddenly sees that the bus, which he thought had just blown up, is still sending a signal. Now, he's trying to figure out, what? How can this be? This is... No! So suddenly we understand what the scream was about. The scream is precisely about the semiotic, the recognition of the semiotic signature that this jump, that this sudden presence and absence of the purse disambiguates. That is, the status of what he thought was a live image with its indexical guarantees is suddenly revealed to be, in fact, a recording. And that recognition produces a shock of terrible traumatic horror. That shock, that trauma of the question of the legibility of the live, of the indexical signature of an image is, in fact, I want to suggest, one of the key signatures of a certain cultural media hermeneutic moment of ours. And it's nowhere better to can one see this than in the increasing use, so I would argue, of surveillance for an idiom that is of a very different order and yet which depends on precisely these questions of ambiguity. Now, I want to show you the beginnings, and this will be my last example, of one final film, a recent film by Michael Haneke called Caché. This is how the film begins. Now listen very carefully and pay attention very carefully. So the credits, these very small credits, excruciatingly slowly unfold across the screen, seemingly over the background of a still photographic image. The quality of this image, the temporality of this image is essential, so please be patient. First semiotic revision imperative. It's not a photograph. It's a temporal image, right? It's a time-based image. Do you see the guy who walked across the image, right? Okay. You can miss it if you don't pay attention. This is important. No sound. The name of the street on the right, the street sign on the right is Rue des Iris, the Iris Street. Another signifier of the time-based image. This is a really static image for an opening film, a shot of a film. What are we watching here? Whose point of view is this? Sonic cue.
I am?
What? What's that? What is it? He says, what?
Stu.
Where was this?
Dans un sac plastique dans la porte.
It was in some kind of an envelope in front of the door.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a?
What's up? What's that? Where are you going?
Cut.
Now we're in a different... Notice the light is different. First cut of the film. Sound cue seems to indicate that he's just gone out of the house. Here we get to see the name of the street better. We recognize, that's...
Il aurait dû être là, non?
Must have been here, no?
Rentre.
Come back in.
Demain, je demanderai au Rochin et au Beaufet s'ils ont vu quelque chose.
Il a dû rester là un bon moment.
J'ai déjà appelé Antoine, il n'a rien vu.
Must have been there for quite a while.
Et Marie n'est pas là, répondeur. La cassette fait plus de 2 heures.
Suddenly we realize we're not watching, we're watching a videotape. Which is to say we're watching. We're watching the watching of the guy who just came out of the house. So suddenly, the opening shot of the film puts us in the position of surveillance spectatorship, or spectators of a surveillance, the status of which is completely inscrutable.
Je ne sais pas, pas longtemps après toi, vers 9h15,
surveillance.
On soit téléphoné pour
un tape.
Attendez.
For those of you who haven't seen the film, I'm not going to say too much. Suffice it to say that, without revealing anything, what's really important about this film is that we never really ever come to understand what this surveillance is about. Because, in fact, the surveillance becomes a figure of something else, of unworked out traumatic memory, etc., etc. But the question is, what is the narrative function of the surveillance? It no longer, in a certain sense, is even of the order of something like the evidentiary. It's begun to serve other narrative ends. And the disambiguation, the question of its legibility, becomes a legibility that is no longer simply of the order of the indexical. What is it an image of? Is this an image? Is this a true image? But rather, it raises the question of the hermeneutic urgency of legibility of a surveillance image, of the surveillance image. Too cool, of the question of how such images function. So, I have lots more examples, but I think I will stop with one scream and save all future, all further examples for our discussion in our seminar. Thank you very much. I hope it's not just going to be interrogatoire. I hope it's going to be, you know, truly dialogic. I'm interested in your proposals as well. Questions, comments, objections? You got to speak up.
What you were mentioning in the end, I think it really, besides this urgency, I think it poses the question of ownership, and this is, again, in order not to tell too much about this really completely outstanding film. Yeah. I think this seems to me one of the crucial questions when we talk about images, and especially these images that are happening in real time. Yeah, who is owning these images? Yeah, the same in Speed. Yeah, I mean, who is taking over ownership, and what do these shifts and changes of ownership actually produce, yeah, in the way how we experience not only surveillance as victims, yeah, but also opening up a completely different realm of possibilities, how we can. And then again, I think this is a perfect link to what Anselm's programmatic proposal yesterday. Yeah, not to expand the image, but to break the image.
Not to. And not you have to speak a little up.
Not to. I think. Not to expand the image and break the narrative, but as he suggested it, to break the image and expand the narrative. Yeah. I'm so stupid. I have to continue some associations. Have you ever thought of the second season of L Word? Second season of L Word, this TV series, yeah, where the entire
of L
L Word. It's
L Word. Sorry, yeah, got it. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Where all of a sudden, the new flatmate, yeah, who's moving into the flat of mm-hmm. the with the two lesbian girls, installs a kind of webcam surveillance system. For several purposes. Yeah. First, he wanted to sell it to a porn producer. Then he wants to make a documentary film about how the life of young lesbians is really. Yeah. And in the end, he, by stealing these images or taking over ownership over these images, he creates all sorts of other confusions, which in the end, I think, and this is why I found it really interesting, because the first season was so boring and really flat, yeah, mirrors the kind of voyeuristic pornographic perspective of the audience, yeah, because this is a mainstream. Mm-hmm. It's not a subculture project. It's a mainstream mm-hmm. product, yeah. And so on. But originally, I wanted to smoke a cigarette.
Just two quick comments. It's a super interesting suggestion. First, ownership of the image is, in fact, it's an extremely important and productive way to think about this. It also is the title of a translation of a very important book by a guy named, a French theorist named Bernard Edelman. The English translation is Ownership of the Image, the subtitle of which is Outlines for a Marxist Theory of Law. The French title is Le Droit de l'Image, Droit à l'Image. And it's a history of the juridical debates surrounding early photography and the question of who owns a photograph. What is it when I make a photograph of you? Do I own the photograph, or is it because it's your image that you have some rights to it? And it, of course, raises the immediately confronts the extraordinarily important fact that who bought the rights, which is to say the ownership of the photographic process from Daguerre? The French state, right? So the ownership of the image, of the state's relationship to the image, is one that is immediately at the start, at the moment of the invention of the technology, or shortly thereafter, becomes a political matter in the most literal statist sense of the term. Second comment. One of the first attempts to render a quotidian life as web spectacle, it was this famous experiment by an undergraduate named Jennifer Ringley, so-called Jenny Cam, which you may be familiar with. Victor Bergen has a nice essay on the psychoanalytic, voyeuristic, narcissistic dimensions of this particular project. But suffice it to say here, in response to your L-word suggestion, that if you, the idea was, she set up a webcam which where you watched her daily life. That meant when she was doing her homework, when she was cooking, sleeping, sometimes she would get undressed, have sex with her boyfriend, but basically it was mostly deeply quotidian banality. Nevertheless, it attracted an incredible voyeuristic following, such that, and this is the most interesting symptom, if you typed in any variant in the phonemic neighborhood of Jenny Cam, you got hardcore porn. And that was not accidental. In other words, the recognition that the people looking for this particular site were interested in a certain kind of economy of spectacle was not accidental. So this relation between a kind of pornographic spectacle, and that particular form of non-eventhood, which is surveillance spectacle, is one that would be really worth looking into more carefully.
Helen? Helen, can you just take the mic?
I can probably yell. The simple question is, you said that you could talk later about low res. I'd like to hear you do that.
Hmm. Let's look at an image. I'm a great believer that if we're going to talk in, if we have the luxury of being in a space where we can look at images, let's take a look at something like, hold on, let's look at this. Here's one example. An image from a so-called smart bomb. Or the a more disturbing version of this from vigilantes. You've seen this. Basically, this is this posted on YouTube for a while. It's a group of vigilantes sitting in the back, driving in the back of a van. And anytime a car comes anywhere close to them, you hear them shooting at it? They shoot at the cars until they stop.
Train.
There's a gun. Okay. So, perhaps the easiest example in with which one could talk about the way that pop culture has appropriated an aesthetics that comes from video phone reportage from embedded journalists, from these kinds of home movie missives, from Middle East conflict. The best example of the way that has taken on a new quality of authenticity is to think about a project like Blair Witch. The Blair Witch Project, which precisely mobilizes an aesthetics of dilettantism, of low res, of unprofessionalism, as another way to counter the anxiety about slick post-production, or slickness as signifier of post-production. Thus, amateurism, dilettantism, degraded image, et cetera, all function in a way to provide a seductive lure of a kind of authenticity by default. And Blair Witch is only the most, in a sense, immediately available example. The proliferation of a handheld aesthetic that we associate with cinema verite and various forms of foregrounded economies of image making in which the cameraman's presence with regard to the material at hand is inscribed through the jerkiness of the camera would be the kind of work that I would point to expand that further. Does that help?
Yeah. Can I follow up? Because it's precisely resolution.
Susan, can you just take the mic?
I wanted to follow up because for me it's precisely the question of resolution that in a way undoes that opening sequence of cachet, because the tape that gets delivered to the couple in the apartment is not a high definition video. It's on
a
VHS tape. And so we have this ambiguity, yet we begin with a 35 millimeter image that's absolutely clear. There's no electronic interference. And so we're in. So right. How do we understand that kind of moment? It is surveillance, but clearly it's not. There's right. This kind of duplicity that's happening, and everybody sees that tape, we immediately understand that the image that for me, what its capacity is such that it in a, for me, that kind of strange, not knowing what it is that we're watching, is it 35 millimeter, is it electronic magnetic tape, I think takes us to the very last sequence of the film, where once again we have to ask those questions in terms of the live, the recorded, etc. But I mean, in basically, I'm trying to say that I think that Haneke, in a way, subverts his intention, perhaps, precisely through that kind of clarity of that opening shot,
well,
which can't really be surveillance.
Okay, a couple of thoughts. Important observation. By pointing out the ways in which narrative cinema refunctions to its ends images of ostensible surveillance, this would be only, Haneke's example is only the last in a series of examples that we looked at today. So, for example, think of Thelma Louise, when you have this grainy black and white high angle shot marked as surveillance visually, which happens to have, which surveillance images almost never do, perfect sync sound, right? Now, that already there, you have something like a, shall we say, remapping or refunctioning of a surveillance image precisely in terms of the economy of narrative cinema, right? And thus, its authenticity as a proper surveillance image is, in a sense, less important than its narrative function, which the sync sound only serves to promote. I would argue in the Haneke case, however, unlike those, and I mean, we could look at many examples in which that, you know, stretching of the surveillance the low-res quality of the surveillance image is stretched onto the Procrustean bed of narrative intelligibility. This happens throughout, and I would argue, first and foremost, in temporal terms, by having surveillance function, as it does mostly in narrative cinema, as a delivery vehicle for events, for eventhood. In fact, that's not what surveillance is about. Most of the time, nothing happens on the surveillance image. So if we wanted to be properly surveillant, whatever that means, what that kind of normative surveillant normativity, in a certain sense, the surveillance image would have to have a kind of extension, kind of duration that it rarely is allowed to have in narrative cinema. In that context, the opening of the Haneke image, if we leave aside for a moment the question of resolution, in its duration is in fact undisturbingly long, and as such, much closer to a certain kind of surveillance economy than most of the surveillance images that, or the kind of surveillance material that appears in narrative cinema. The fact that its status as an actual surveillance, that it would be more believable as low res, begs, however, the question, because that would be to assume that the issue is, well, who made that surveillance, and was there somebody out there, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's not clear, without wanting to give away too much, whether there ever was any surveillance in this film, whether this is in itself simply a conceit for the return of the repressed, to say no more than that. I think you understand what I'm saying, for those of you who have seen the film, so that the diegetic plausibility of its resolution, in a certain sense, is not the, or you could, even if you want to make a stronger version of this argument, you could say it's precisely in refusing that diegetic plausibility of low res that the film asks the question even more urgently, in what way is the surveillance part of the very same narration that governs the rest of the thoroughly saturated celluloid of the film as a whole. Does that make sense? Nevertheless, the deformations of surveillance in the name of narrative instrumentalization is something that you will find all over the place. Absolutely. Please.
I have a few questions and comments.
Please.
Great presentation, by the way.
Thank you.
What I'm curious is to hear what you have to say about what I see as the evolution of surveillance into the sort of widespread phenomenon of reality TV, and the sort of difference between the two and the artificiality of that as the reality of this. And I guess
what's this? What's this?
Surveillance is sort of
what?
It's the absence of a person behind a camera, I guess. The more sort of honest capturing of the footage, and then I guess that also sort of reminds me of a collection of essays by Abigail Solomon about documentary photography and the role of the person behind the camera and capturing that sort of honesty. And I guess maybe it's the difference between the absence of the viewers immediately there and the presence of it.
Whoa, you're going a little fast. What kind of honesty and what kind of viewer? You got to unpack
that. Well, something about the presence of someone behind a camera and capturing that footage, I guess, and then the absence of someone behind a camera and capturing footage.
I see. In other words, manned a camera which has, as it were, somebody looking through the viewfinder versus a kind of automatic.
I guess the reaction to the sort of people that are being captured or the things being captured behind.
You know, your question raises a really important issue that I didn't have time to talk about today, and that is with the proliferation of surveillance, however theatricalized or not the gathering surveillance video is today, our culture is posed confronted with a problem, and it's a problem that we'll talk about. We can talk about East Germany later, but the question is what do you do with so much footage which nobody has the time to watch, right? One of the great challenges that the proliferation of this material thus poses is how we can automate viewing, which is to say, how we can mechanize not only the production, the capture, the inscription of images, but the hermeneutic process of their decryption, of their reading as well. Machine vision. That is the challenge to artificial intelligence to be able to produce structures that allow for an automatic analysis of images in real time, in a certain sense, is one of the great issues of our cultural moment as well. It's something that the videos of Harun Faruqi, for example, in a series of installations he did called iMachine, explore. In the context of in proliferation of robotics, et cetera, et cetera. But this idea that the question of reading images is currently being subjected to itself a mechanization raises all kinds of interesting questions. Sorry, one last comment. The question that you raise about the reality of television obviously is a huge one. And would be a topic of not only another seminar but of a semester. It's enormously interesting, and its epidemic proliferation is hugely symptomatic. I would just point you to perhaps the most interesting limit case of the reality television, the appropriation of the reality television idiom, and that is an amazing piece of political theater by a renegade young German filmmaker in Austria named Christoph Schlingensief. I don't know if you're familiar with this amazing project called Ausländer raus, Foreigners Out. In the wake of the election of Haider, Schlingensief set up a Big Brother container on the Ringstrasse in Vienna in which he put a dozen Asylanten, asylum seekers. And the idea was every day the Austrians could vote for one of these asylum seekers to be thrown out of the country, and the person left at the end would be granted citizenship. And this, produced an incredible drama of, left-wing activists who stormed the container in their humorlessness, not recognizing it as a piece of agitprop theater, et cetera, et cetera. But using precisely the entrenchedness of the reality televisual idiom as a mechanism for, as a vehicle for political theater. A remarkable project, which is all too unknown in the United States, and as a performance for questions of evasions of power, it seems to me worthy of mention in this context.
How
One of my
a little bit about two issues, one of which is about the aestheticization of surveillance, both as a popular cultural strategy and as a high art or, you know, agitprop or, you know, gallery-based practice. Because it seems to me that there's something, I mean, there's something problematic there about the aestheticization of...
By aestheticization, you mean what?
I mean actually mobilization of the image, of the surveillant image, either for narrative terms, for narratualized terms, or for, as you said, in these various artistic practices, for sort of contemplative or critical purposes, ends, let's say. And then I wanted, and that's one question. And the other question was that I was wondering if, because we talked a little bit last night about, Sam brought up the Protestant Reformation. If you could talk about this question of the surveillant as an agency that already existed within the Protestant Reformation, as a kind of sacralization of the non-eventfulness of everyday life as this site of Protestant self-surveillance, and how these technologies have been sort of prepared for by a certain kind of attitude towards the non-eventfulness of everyday life as a significant site of divine care and intervention. And I'm thinking, you know, the most obvious thing is that, you know, you cited a lot of Northern European artists, and Big Brother, as we know, came from Holland. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's an accident that this mode of visual techniques comes from the heartland of the Reformation.
Beautiful comment. You know, what can I say? Yes, without a doubt. it's not by accident that in a country, Holland, whose urban fabric is marked, among other things, as anybody who's ever spent time there knows, by a particular economy of windows, which allow for people to look in, but one shouldn't look in, et cetera, et cetera. It's also a place where there are some of the most perfectly intact series of perfectly intact surveillance panoptic prisons, one of which, as many of you architects know, was the focus of a famous project that Rem Koolhaas proposed for how do you rethink this mise-en-scène in the late 20th century? What kind of program would a remodeling of a panoptic structure today require? Sacralization of the non-eventhood of the quotidian. It's a super interesting thought, and I'm not sure what to do with that. Maybe I'm sorry I wasn't here last night or yesterday to understand the context. I'm not sure what the question is there. It's certainly, you know, in the genealogy of the panoptic, the at least at the level of the iconographic. One of the important strands, of course, is, and we have it on our dollar bill in its Masonic variant, is the Eye of God. And in that particular, I don't know if you saw at Eastern State, if I'm remembering correctly, but if I recall correctly, one of the interesting Quaker variants of the panoptic was the fact that certain cells had a hole in the ceiling. Did they talk about this? Which is to say, one that allowed for a supervision, as it were, of a vertical as opposed to horizontal vector. You may have to unpack a little bit more for me the second question, because I'm not sure I understand how it was working last night.
By, you know, making it melodramatic and eventful in its narrativization,
yes.
It builds up of this I'm thinking of, you know, the Robinson Crusoe and these 17th century narratives where people were making a catalog of everyday life, but it's seen as insignificant, the detritus of things, and this intensive focus. That
the miracle, the miracle that is caused by Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So this, film plays this strange role of absorbing this, mm-hmm. making it, absorbing the not eventful, making it visual and dramatic. And I don't have anywhere to go with this.
Yeah, I guess I would use and Benjamin in responding to both that and your first question about the aestheticization, because if you remember in the artwork essay, one of the really interesting questions that Benjamin poses is how this new calibration of that what film cinema represents in its montage, in the rapidity of the images, is a kind of recalibration of perception. Where that recalibration functions both as a rendering visible of a new perceptual economy, a la Zimmel, the Metropolis and Mental Life, but it also functions to retool the individual to be able to have a certain kind of mastery over that which would otherwise, in a position of overwhelming him, oppress him or her. And Benjamin is mentions both of these moments. And as such, he says, cinema is the most important object for that particular theory of perception, for the theory of perception which the Greeks called aesthetics. So that the aestheticization of surveillance, understood as a rendering phenomenal, a rendering visible, which is to say rendering capable of scrutiny, of mastery, et cetera, is not only a banalization, depoliticization, quietistic, et cetera, which the classic argument of aestheticization would insist on, but it's simultaneously also something like a, presenting for at least potential critical interrogation, and then finally, what would it mean to have a kind of mastery? And that's why I end with the Hanukkah example, because this would be, I would suggest, an instance of where a surveillant literacy, a certain kind of narrative mastery of surveillance, can, and I forgive the kind of implicit Hegelian logic of this, but having achieved a certain kind of mastery of a certain surveillance idiom, it becomes available in the Hanukkah film, and there are others that I could point to, for other expressive ends. The surveillance in Hanukkah is not about surveillance in any trivial sense. What does it tell us that suddenly this idiom has become an expressive modality for certain kinds of historical anxiety, trauma, et cetera, et cetera? That's interesting to me. So does that begin to answer?
Yes. That clarifies the problem for me, because it's a love that I've encountered. Mm-hmm. And that is that the
Now, let me make one footnote. That said, there's lots of self-indulgent hijacking of the sexiness, topicality, and facile appeal of surveillance in cinema, in the art world. There's nothing more easy in a certain sense than to hijack the lure of the real-time image, of the closed-circuit image, et cetera, et cetera. So that we have to, this is why we have to develop, and this is in a certain sense the project behind my exhibit Control Space, to begin to catalog the work that's been done in this domain precisely in order to be able to differentiate work that simply is a one-liner, simply a self-indulgent appropriation of a certain cultural visual economy, from work that, and I would argue, early Vito Acconci following works, for example, really are a kind of intervention. Or another work, which I didn't show you, by Jonas Dahlberg, where you come in and you see a video monitor with what looks like a video of a surveillance of a toilet. And then when you go in the toilet that this monitor is standing in front of, you see, in fact, it is a real-time image of that toilet, except it's an image of a tiny-scale model of the space that you're in, thus raising the question of the readability of scale in the surveillance image. or an early Dan Graham installation. Both of these were also in my show called Yesterday Today, where you come in, you see a monitor in which you see the bar outside the entrance to the exhibit at the ZKM, and it looks like, well, it looks like a surveillance feed. What's up with that? The piece is called Yesterday Today. What's at stake is the image is a real-time surveillance image from the bar. The soundtrack is from exactly that time the day earlier. Every day we recorded the sound and played it back the next day at exactly the same time. What is at stake there? Precisely the readability of the supposed sound image coordination, which is assumed but nothing guarantees, and thus raises another question about surveillance intelligibility. Those are the kinds of works that produce kind of critical, you know, raise kind of critical questions. Other much more self-indulgent pieces, I think we can differentiate. But what differentiates them is the questions they ask, the way they ask them, how they mobilize images, and not the fact whether they're, not all mobilization of surveillance per se is aestheticization in the reactionary sense that I just described.
I know there's quite a few questions. I just want to pose one, going back to that Haneke film. And in a certain sense, that scene you showed us is the perfect illustration of this moment in Derrida's fourth and fifth seminars on hospitality, where he suggests that email and other surveillance technologies have completely upended our conception of the home, and they've upended our sense of feeling a mastery over the home. And the repercussion of that, the ramification, is that in a certain sense, at least Derrida argues, if we follow him, is that feeling a certain mastery over one's home is a precondition for extending hospitality to others. And so in that film, if I'm remembering what happens after correctly, a series of dinner parties and invitations to others in that home keep getting interrupted by the surveillance footage. And hospitality seems to disappear as well as their own, in a way, comfort in their own private space. The demarcation of private and public has been completely eroded. So
I would only add to that, it's a marvelous observation, that what the notion of the chez soi, of the home, of my own space that is eroded in this film is in fact not that of the literal domesticity in which those scenes take place, but in fact his comfortable and increasingly disrupted comfort with his own history, which is to say his own notion, his own childhood, which is another space of chez soi, of being at home, which becomes haunted and indeed thoroughly contaminated by that otherness which the surveillance names, without in this regard having to be literal.
And it's precisely what happens, you already spoke to this, with the conception of the archive. The archive is something also that surveillance technologies upend. I know you were speaking before of what to do with all this footage in a certain sense, and Derrida always felt that email, in a certain sense, was upending the classical conception of the archive. But anyway, I'm going to stop there. I know Eyal had something, and Sir John as well.
Yeah. Okay, Tom, I want to ask you something. If you can say a little bit more about what I see as a difference between the surveillance of a behavior and the surveillance of a place.
Surveillance of behavior and place.
I mean, by behavior meaning that you were showing people and animals and something happening, and the surveillance of a place. I think there was one moment when you spoke about Neumann's installation at the Dia Beacon, where this was particularly true. In the sense of that we start watching in a place being almost as drastically transformed, perhaps even more than the image, which we now try to conceptualize and try to see what to do with in the future. And the other day, just 2 days ago, we had a seminar with Walid Rad, and also we had the discussion about withdrawal, issue of withdrawal from the image, withdrawal of certain elements from it, in a sense to break it, but in a sense to expand something else. That was also the point of Anson's yesterday that was mentioned earlier, to break the image and to expand the narrative.
What does breaking the image mean in
this
context?
I don't know what it is.
Where is Anza?
But
what I wanted to ask is, it would be interesting to hear your opinion, whether it is actually worth studying the deformation of a place, whether it is productive, as much as it is productive studying the transformation of the image, because place is changing drastically. If you look at a place where the Big Brother is shot, right, we come to the level of efficiency that we know what is the most efficient layout.
Indeed.
And a height.
A layout entirely for panoptical accessibility instrumentality.
Exactly. And in fact, it ends up being an inverse panopticon. It actually has a cross shape. And it basically, we now start speaking about the breaking of the place as much as you speak of the continuity of the image in the Big Brother phenomenon. Now, can you say something about, can we talk about the difference of the surveillance of the behavior and the surveillance of a place at all? Or do we have to talk about continuous blurring of the two?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I don't know how to make a rigorous distinction. You'll have to help me some more. I don't really understand what's at stake in the question.
Maybe you can expand on Naumann's installation at the Dia Beacon, and since what you shown first and you said was really was an image of a static series of images, right?
Right.
Of a studio in a place which is within another place, which is of a different dimensions in all aspects.
Okay, let me see if this helps, and just tell me to stop if it's not along the lines of what you were asking. The Naumann installation that I showed, and I hope it wasn't misleading, is a series of huge video projections, time-based images, that when you come into the space, and the Boburg installation was, I think, seven huge projections. At the List Center at MIT recently, in a show called Sensations, they had a single projection. So it's shown in various configurations. What you witness are images that, like the images I began to talk about at the outset of my presentation, are initially undecidable in their semiotic signature. Is this a still? Nothing's moving. Nothing's happening. And only after a certain amount of time, when something flits or something is marked, do we begin to read it as a time-based image. Okay, so we have a group of 1 to 7 time-based projections of night scene, so marked by that particular telltale infrared green that we've come to know from various images from conflict zones, which are then subject to a series of transformations. Inversion on this axis, inversion on this axis, subjected to various color washes, etc., etc. What is this a spectacle of? It's a spectacle of the site of, or the locus of artistic production, to the extent that the artist's studio has classically been that site. But the artist's studio, absent the artist, and indeed his position as agent of production has been replaced by a video camera that is recording. Agency returns, however, and in a certain sense, all encounters of surveillance and artists are always already an encounter of, or a drama of the agon of agency. In the sense that, what does he do with those images? Do we just have 8-hour untouched continuous. No, agency returns precisely in these various treatments. In fact, it goes much further. He provides a score, literally with time codes, 17 hours, 32 minutes, mouse runs across, et cetera, et cetera. So that something like the recuperation of the aleatory of chance for something like the construction of an oeuvre, of a work. That reimposition of something like form and shaping, which is to say the work of agency, in a certain sense, I would argue, is the least interesting part of that of the piece. It's precisely what makes the piece, in a certain sense, this is harsh, reactionary. And in that regard, it might be a candidate for what Catherine was suggesting of a certain kind of aestheticization. That's interesting given that Naumann would also be, for me, an example in his early works of somebody who most rigorously and systematically cataloged the phenomenality of new forms of self-understanding of space and subjecthood, et cetera, in his early video corridors, et cetera, et cetera. So why that might be, we could speculate. Does this begin to answer?
Absolutely. Also, it seems to me that that what you are now saying is especially in the Naumann piece, is that we're talking about the aesthetization of a place of the image rather than the image of a place. Mm-hmm. And that said, basically the issues of aestheticizations are going into multiple dimensions and are actually really distorting not just anamorphically the what is recognizable as a shape on the screen, mm-hmm. but an actual behavior which is there without even being surveyed, because in a Naumann piece we are not surveyed. We are basically inside.
How are we inside?
Inside his piece, which
see.
Is in her
I see. We spectators.
Right.
See, yes.
I think it seems to me that there is a kind of parallel story to the story of the development of surveillance technology, and that is the kind of this, the developments of ways in which it is manipulated, subverted, doctored, etc., right? How it is abused.
Of course.
Appropriated. Mm-hmm. I remember when Haroun Farocki was presenting his machine image and then his kind of smart bomb footage, he was speaking of them as not being media, because, in fact, they're operational footage, right? But obviously, and I think this is something he's definitely aware of, although he was showing images of the first Gulf War, you know, most of the military work was not done by these bombs, but this is the way in which the war was actually mediatized, right?
So, which is to say they're operational, but in a media rhetorical sense.
Yeah, so in fact, they operated in kind of producing consent and support for the war. Mm-hmm. So while, you know, bulldozers were burying kind of surrendered Iraqi soldiers in the desert, this is what the Americans were seeing at home.
Right.
But as well, kind of the if one is looking at various other examples by which both surveillance cameras, the footage has been doctored. Their kind of status as evidence as well in court is constantly being put into question. So I think that perhaps I'd like to kind of to ask you to speak a little bit about the way in which that the story of the manipulation of these images, of doctoring of these images, is kind of folded into the narrative of their development.
The question of the reliability of images today, and surveillance images name just one economy of images in which that this agon is taking place, is perhaps nowhere better exemplified than in a really strange piece of propaganda that I got. I'm sure you've seen this. I don't remember what it was called, but the basic gist of this is pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinian piece was the following. It was a kind of journalistic expose that took images of, let's say, Beirut, and through a kind of forensics of representation. And forgive me if this is something that is super familiar to you folks. Just stop me.
It is familiar, but it's an interesting example.
Yeah. Would say, okay, you see this image of Beirut? Now let me show you the original image. And you see that the amount of smoke has been drastically increased. Mm-hmm. Right? So the representation, the issue there is, aha, digital intervention in digital post-production, right? The more pop cultural variant in the United States was this astonishing moment in the wake of the O.J. Simpson trial when O.J., the same mugshot of O.J. appeared on Time and Newsweek, except one of them, I don't remember which, had made him slightly darker. And the third example was the case of the Korean doctor who had digitally manipulated some scientific images, which made a huge scandal about the question of how images that had been published in Nature, how science can go about adjudicating the evidentiary value of certain scientific images of scientific experiments. In the case of the Middle East propaganda that I began by invoking, what's really interesting is the rhetorical consequence. Because you have an image of a scene of devastation, the rhetorical move is to say, because, as you can see here, smoke has been added, therefore, nothing in the image is true. That is, that there's a kind of all or nothingness allows the recognition of a potentially significant but potentially strictly rhetorical post-production intervention to undermine all referential claims of the image. And this astonishing all or nothing economy is, and this is going to be an extremely polemical analogy, remarkably reminiscent of Holocaust denial. How so? Because the rhetorics of Holocaust denial are, since you can't prove without any doubt that this happened, the possibility of doubt means that we have to raise the question of maybe this is not the case. And thus, in a rhetoric that would see itself as the most furthest opposed from that discourse as possible, we have, in terms of the kind of rhetorics of image referentiality, a discourse that is shockingly analogous in its structure. It, in both cases, speaks of an anxiety about what it is that allow images to make claims. And in a sense, my interest in surveillance is simply as one of many economies of images that are raising the question of their referential reliability. In a certain sense, surveillance is important to me only as that, as an economy of imaging, which is precisely, irreducibly about the always already political question of reference. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But how does this relate to the concept of mastery? Well, does this relate to the concept of mastery introduced
The question was, how does this relate to the concept of mastery? I think, are you referring to when I invoked this notion of surveillant literacy? Because what I would like to, what I'm suggesting there is to say, look, films produce effects of surveillant literacy in various ways. Some of them thematically. So if you've seen the film Enemy of the State, it is a kind of primer in how to do surveillance, how it is that they can put a bug in a pen, how it is that they can introduce a bug in a light, what it means to have identity theft, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In that regard, it literally, in a classic Enlightenment project, wants to teach you about what surveillance does, right? You could say the same thing about The Wire. We learn about how you introduce certain kinds of surveillance technologies into certain kinds of urban spaces. There's another sense of literacy, though, that I'm also invoking, which is that which is produced by the provocation to reflect on issues of surveillance, to be forced to confront precisely the lack of facile intelligibility, the problematic status of reference in the surveillance image. That, too, is a product of certain kinds of work done with surveillance in less in contemporary cinema than in certain kinds of contemporary art. But it's that latter kind of what I would call productive, critical literacy. I don't think I used the word mastery, but if I did, I would prefer to use the word literacy that I'm interested in.
There's quite a few questions, and I want to get to everybody, but Schumann actually has been waiting for enormously long time, and then Lindsay, maybe.
Thank you for a really wonderful and entertaining kind of afternoon, and it's brilliant because it's Saturday afternoon, and it felt like a kind of Saturday matinee, you know, and that's perfect.
That's always my desire.
It's really, really good.
Be a matinee idol.
Two things to say. One is just a tiny bit of marginalia, and the second maybe a comment. The first marginalia is when you showed the shaking in time code, mm-hmm. you know, the deployment of the earthquake. I mean,
which is most completely people, artificial.
Well, yeah, but there's a kind of other pragmatic reason for that, no? Which many people may know, but it's worth sort of rehearsing, which is simply that these earthquakes recur basically as a way to get everyone in sync. Yeah. So because the film's shot in one take, so no one knows. So every sort of, I don't know, whatever, 30 minutes, there needs to be the earthquake so that everyone knows they're in place, so that all the dialogue and the plot is back in sync. Because if they didn't have that, someone could finish the film 5 minutes before someone else, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a kind of really interesting
absolutely.
Kind of, you know, where the kind of indexical and the absolutely dead pragmatic kind
right.
of meet
very
head
nice.
Head to head. Mm-hmm. And then the second is actually...
Can I just add, because I didn't say this when I invoked it, it's actually crucial, you know, precisely this thespian pragmatics of the shaking points to the fact that it is an entirely artificially introduced formalism, right? It is not precisely not of the order of the referential, or rather what it references is the synchronization and nothing more. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the second, which is more of a comment, I don't know if it'll end in a question or not, but is just a sort of thing about the kind of economy of boredom within sort of surveillance footage, and the sort of and the transformation of boredom as inadequacy to boredom as a kind of spectacular surplus. Okay, and let me try and flesh this out. So one example for me that really comes to mind that you may have kind of dealt with in terms of the sort of history of art cinema would be Michael Snow's Wavelength.
Mm.
Yeah. So, you know, Michael Snow's Wavelength is kind of 1 hour, you know, deadpan teleological zoom, no, set in this sort of, in his studio in his loft in New York in the early 70s. And the key, one of the key things in Wavelength is sort of two-thirds through the way in this sort of, This thing where nothing seems to happen, no? Nothing, just this empty, this zoom, 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 is, there's this key point, and Laura Mulvey points this out, where, you know, do we see the body, a dead body, no? Do we see a corpse? And it's not clear. You know, and it's the only, and it's the only bit of kind of possible dramaturgy that takes place. And that, for me, is a kind of echo, of course, back to 8 years before, I think it's about 8 years, no? Antonioni's blow-up. You know, again, did the photographer see the dead body? No? So in both of these instances, there's this kind of notion of the kind of phantom of death, yeah, which gets dramatized as a corpse that is or isn't there. But for me, what's actually at play there, of course, is not so much the you know, the phantom of the dead body is really about the kind of the phantom of death in the medium or the media of both photography and cinema. And I imagine that, you know, so Barth would say that death is the kind of punctum, maybe, you know, or the kind of death mask and this kind of stuff. I would argue, and it really kind of happens in Wavelength for me, that it's to do with boredom to some extent, you know. And particularly, you know, because at one level, Wavelength is the most boring film like you could potentially watch, but also the most thrilling. And it's sort of really interesting that in this sort of fantastically rigorous piece of, you know, sort of, you know, early 70s process-orientated movie, that, you know, this kind of the dead body, you know, the classic dramaturgical trope appears. And then what that kind of made me think of is, you know, it's how God Waiting for Godot starts. You know? Sort of, nothing happens, nobody comes, nobody goes. And then that sort of makes me think, like, you know, one of the things I love most about watching Big Brother, and I do watch mainly celebrity Big Brother, is I get home at night at about 1 or 2 in the morning and I switch on the TV and I watch people sleep. You know, and night, and what they do is they fill up all nighttime transmission with just footage of the contestants sleeping, and it's night vision, no? So And this is and I just, I mean, sometimes I'll sit and I'll watch it, but sometimes I'll just have it on in the background.
Ambient.
Uh-huh. You know, yeah. But this is, of course, this is Warhol's sleep, no? This is, it's Truman Show. And I think what's sort of really interesting is that, for me, that's this kind of, something's happened in that whole loop, you know, where boredom is once, considered to be an inadequacy, somehow is kind of completely looped around to become a kind of surplus, literally a surplus, no? Because it's broadcast late at night. They still have ad breaks, which is interesting. They still have ad breaks.
Really? So they're too a marking of time.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Of media time, network time. Yeah.
And you know, and this kind of, and you know, and given that so many of your examples are the, you know, sort of hovering back and forth between kind of high art world and pop culture.
Right.
I thought that might be a kind of interesting thing to just
super
add.
Interesting. You know, it would be really interesting, and thank you for the very interesting comments. I have a couple of thoughts. It would be enormously interesting to do a kind of, first at the, strictly the level of, you know, archival fact gathering, comparative analysis of the particular kinds of spectacle used for late night filler. And what my counterexample from Berlin, late night television from Berlin in the 80s, and I don't know if any of you ever saw this, but it's hilarious, and not only because of my particular interest in model railroading, which, for those of you who know about the MIT Model Railroad Club, is at the origin of all computer culture, but anyway, that's another story. In Berlin late night television, what you saw was a camera on the front. There are two versions. One is in the front of a train driving through somewhere in Europe, the endless recessional vision of the tracks. So, like, you know, kind of hypnotic, teleological, forward-going itinerary. The subterranean and version, and this comes closer to the figuration of a kind of nocturnalism, was the same camera on the subway, underground. Again, just blackness and that which is illuminated by the headlight of the subway, you know, without interruption, because it's state television, no commercials, just trains, just, and that difference of an economy of, you know, in a certain sense, it's a figure for a certain kind of narrativity, even though it's reduced to the zero point, but still there's something like progression, whereas the figure of the sleeper. in its, you know, Warholian fascination. And you have to think in that regard of which one of the surrealists was it who, when he went to sleep, put a sign outside his door, "Le poète travaille," dream as a locus of productivity. But in any case, so the issue of ambient spectacle raises the question of also what kind of spectatorship, because in fact the literalism of the sleeping is only foregrounds the condition that in a certain sense a properly surveillant image always has, which is in a sense it's both nothing. And as in a marvelous little 10-minute film that this wonderful British director Chris Pettit did called Surveillance, he suggests, and I think it's a very nice insight, he says, you know, look, a surveillance image is always an image that's in anticipation of the crime, right? It's always wondering whether something might happen. In the way that the sleeper image is always, in a sense, a question of will he or she wake up, right? So there's a kind of latent potential for drama. To comment on your Michael Snow point and the figure of the dead body and the possibility, the undecidable possibility of the dead body, what is so important about your comparison with Blow Up is precisely that Blow Up raises the question of agency. Right? I actually don't think it's a question of whether the guy saw the dead body. I think he surely did not. And in fact, it's important that he didn't, because it's precisely the prosthetic eye that allows him to see something that was not available to his agency-driven ocularity. Why is that important? Because in a certain sense, the death, and your invocation of Bart is precisely right in that regard, that is inscribed in these spectacles is precisely the death of a certain kind of agency. And thus I would say the Snow piece that is perhaps most surveillant in this regard and even exponentially more rigorous in its refusal of any logic of spectacle in the strict sense is this unbelievable, and it makes the Nouwen piece look really silly in comparison, is this amazing installation called La Région Centrale, which, if you don't know it, is this unbelievable installation that he did where he went up to a forlorn mountaintop in Canada somewhere, having developed an incredible apparatus that allowed a camera to rotate freely in all axes, and basically had this camera running, and in its installation, which I've never witnessed personally, but which I've seen installation shots of at Beaubourg and read descriptions of, its outputs to four monitors. In other words, privileging, you know, not allowing anything like even a spectatorial position of mastery, because in a certain sense, there's no way that you could ever see, as it were, all the output of this image. So there's a real interesting kind of spectacle where, in a sense, nothing happens. There's no agency. It's continuous time and basta. And the dead body there is precisely the death of a certain kind of agency.
This isn't unrelated to the discussions we were having last night about the indeterminacy that targeting often entails in Weber and Sam's work, and a certain anticipatory or preemptive logic as well. Lindsay Bremner was next. Lindsay, can you just come up and speak into the mic? Sina has one right here.
I was just interested in hearing your remarks on a film that you haven't mentioned yet, and that's Children of Men, which kind of spectacularly collapses space and time. And at the same time, the director makes an enormous amount about the long shot, the sort of single, kind of very lengthy shot in the movie.
I know of it. I haven't seen it. I wish I could talk about it. It's a super interesting film, but I haven't seen it.
That's a quick one.
Sorry, but I mean, if you would like to propose, I'm super interested. I mean, by the way, can I just point out that the terms under which I came to this event were that I would give a presentation, and then all the Goldsmith folks would give presentations too. And it turns out to become an interrogatoire, which I love, don't get me wrong, but...
I'm to blame.
Just for the record.
I wanted to ask you, can you speak a little bit about the comforts of surveillance, which goes a little bit, I think, with what Schumann was bringing up as well, in terms of... the paranoid narrative is, in fact, you know, a solution, not a problem. The paranoid narrative is a solution, not a problem. It works perfectly for the paranoid.
Right, sure. Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it's a comfortable narrative.
Right.
I was wondering if you can speak a little bit about...
Well, okay.
The comforts for the subject of being surveyed.
Sure. Well, look, there are two models, the two models of Big Brother, and the one is the Orwellian... scary Big Brother, and the other one is the comforting sibling Big Brother who is looking out, right? And in a certain sense, we have a good example of that in recent cinema, which is the German film Das Leben der Anderen, right? Okay, but for those of you who haven't seen it, right, it's a study of the Stasi surveillance, and the reactionary politics of the film are precisely that. The problem with Stasi surveillance is not the fact of pandemic surveillance. The problem is not the apparatus that's the problem. The problem is that there are bad people using it. So that, in fact, what the film is about the well-meaning, formerly vicious interrogator who is moved by reading Brecht and hearing certain kind of Eislerian music to become the good Big Brother who, in fact, protects the artist who is under surveillance by more, shall we say, noxious elements of the East German state.
That's a bit of a ruse.
Correct.
I mean, after 89, I know there were cases where people fell apart in former Eastern European countries when the apparatus was taken away, and they knew about that. There were specific, you know, psychological cases of, right. You know, they knew that the surveillance had not been used by, you know, for beneficial, you know, uses.
And yet it provided a comfort.
Can I maybe add something to this?
Yeah.
I want to go back maybe to Enemy of the State, and there was a couple of times the mentioning of the word absence. And I think in this kind of, what Zina just talked about in terms of that kind of paranoia about surveillance that we have today, I'm wondering, there's this kind of, this one space in Enemy of the State, which is the cage, no? Where basically all kind of surveillance is suspended because it's, I mean, I don't know how it's constructed, but some kind of electromagnetic field or whatever that takes everything away. But I think the interesting thing as a space is that it basically, I mean, ultimately leads to isolation, no? Because if you're that paranoid, if you're in that space, you almost have to be there by yourself because you probably wouldn't even trust anyone else. So I'm wondering if you could maybe talk about, I mean, if we would interpret surveillance mm-hmm. in that kind of mm-hmm. negative way, mm-hmm. what's the kind of ultimate spatial future?
I think that's a marvelous point, and I would link it to another a couple of other examples. First, from the space that we saw at the end of the conversation, of which Enemy of the State is a remake, right? Harry Call's apartment, in a certain sense, is precisely a similarly carceral privacy. And this reversal of the panoptic topography is perhaps best captured in two other films. One, a classic of prescient early treatment of surveillance, which is Fritz Lang's last film, the 1960 film The Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse. In which, at the end, without wanting to give too much away, because it's a marvelous film which has just come out on DVD, which you can get and you should watch, it's cheesy and hilarious and symptomatic, the panoptic control booth of the evil surveyors, and for the architects among you, the film, in a certain sense, is about a hotel, which we learned was built by the Nazis, in which every room has eyes. Right, so the idea of a building that sees, space maps. So a kind of panoptic variant, except at the end, the tower, the site of power, the locus of the gaze from into which the prisoner's gaze can never return, becomes the site of incarceration. I won't say more, except to give another example where this is very explicit. Do you remember the Jodie Foster vehicle panic room? All right, so in, what is the panic room? Panic room is precisely the paranoid space par excellence. And in that panic room, which is supposed to be, albeit in the case of an emergency, the space that allows you to not become the victim, to, as it were, master the situation, the panoptic control booth, which is what that panic room is in fact the carceral space. So that which is the condition of differentiation of the panoptic topography tout court collapses upon itself, and the panoptic tower becomes the carceral cell. Right? So the condition of that paranoid mastery produces, you could say, the collapse onto itself of the panoptic. Does that make sense?
What about Rosemary's Baby? Which I think that's an interesting example of the architecture actually producing the conditions of surveillance, because it's the in-laws who are wanting to watch the devil child that are constantly surveilling the female body that's now entrapped in this kind of apartment.
You know, it's been a long time since I've seen it. When I saw it, I wasn't thinking about these things. I'll definitely look at it. I mean, needless to say, just my memory of that film and its oppressive, voyeuristic violations make what you say completely sound completely plausible to me. Absolutely.
I think it's a really interesting parallel to the conversation, because they're filmed at exactly the same point.
And the link is made is beautifully explicit in the comment that a friend of mine made when I spoke to her about it was the end of her pregnancy and how are you feeling, blah blah blah, and she said in marvelous phrase, she says, "I'm tired of being housing."
A few last questions. Helen, I know, has been waiting, and I suspect Anselm, and then Sarah.
I sort of have to apologize for all of us a little bit for the fact that you have been stuck up there. I mean, this is not really how a seminar is supposed to work, although those of us who are required to teach seminars that can have up to 25 people in them know perfectly well that this is what you end up with. But I was actually just thinking as you were talking about the panoptic, that I don't know how good your eyesight is, but if you look at the little monitor on the video camera up there, you'll realize that you are totally being surveyed, because the recording of this event is only recording you. The rest of the audience, we're there on audio, but we're not there. But I guess I was interested in moving away from the panopticon, and I think it's, of course, really interesting that the Eastern State Penitentiary is actually not a panopticon. The Eastern State Penitentiary is panoptic in its spatialization, but not in its operation.
Absolutely.
But I guess there were a couple of things I've been thinking about as you talked, and one of them had to do with your referring to Benjamin's notions of perception. And I was thinking, I mean, the concept of distracted concentration or concentrated distraction is something I've thought about a lot, actually since probably I took one of your classes, long time ago now. And I was thinking, I guess, at the time of scanning, of the way in which I was thinking of because there was a number of documentaries done when I was still living in London. A lot of people here probably saw them, about surveillance in London, in Britain in general, London in particular. And it was at the moment where people were beginning to realize that if you crossed the City of London, and I lived in the Barbican at the time, so I did, it takes maybe 10 minutes to cross it if you're walking towards the river. That the expectation was you would have been recorded on over 300 cameras, right? Which is a remarkable thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember them interviewing the police, or I think it is the police, who monitor the cameras that run down Oxford Street, which are concealed inside these large fixtures that look like lights, but they're actually gyroscopic cameras.
Right.
And they would do bizarre things like track pretty women.
Of course.
They would see people.
Cleavage
and track
shots.
Them,
yeah. Absolutely.
But, of course, most of what they were doing is scanning the image for something that stood out like the body, right? And I was thinking very much that you actually have to pick up a modality of vision that is that sort of concentrated distraction, because you can't concentrate because you're constantly scanning for the peripheral, for the thing that you've missed, for the hidden piece of information that has to somehow emerge out of the banality of that image. And also you have to stop yourself from being bored by the image. If you get sucked into the detail of that banality too much, you can't see that detail, which I think was kind of interesting. It sort of swung around, I think, passing through, I mean, I guess they're sort of linked trajectories, but I was thinking in response to Catherine's question about the sacralization of the banal or of the everyday, of a kind of almost inverse of that, which is the futility of surveillance. And it was to do with this idea of the authentication of the live. And my counterexample to the grainy image is the American obsession on television news with live broadcasting, which, of course, The Daily Show has, you know, exposed and ripped apart to great comic effect. But it's that idea of the live broadcast occurring, and it goes to Sergeant's comment about the place of the image or the image of the place, the live broadcast occurring hours after the event has not only occurred but ended and disappeared from view. So you're there in the place, the broadcast is live, it's coming from the place, but there's nothing there. There's no there.
Right.
And the bizarreness of that, I think, had something to do with the futility of surveillance, because you're surveying the thing after it's gone, I guess.
Many interesting thoughts.
You don't necessarily have to respond.
No, many interesting. Look, a bibliographic reference, an early but still very useful theorization of the question of the live, a marvelous essay that I'm sure many of you know by Marianne Doane called Information Crisis Catastrophe, which looks at the particular example of the Challenger disaster and it, the kind of incessant repetition, but the, also the insistence on maintaining a kind of live locus of broadcast at a site where there was, in fact, nothing to see. My favorite example that I use, most recent example that I'm very interested in, where the question of the live as a feedback loop becomes interesting, was a remarkable instance that happened about 2 years ago when I was living in LA, when a JetBlue plane, which, as you know, has live satellite television in the seat backs, getting late, had a trouble with the landing gear and was going to land on foam, and there was a big preparation. But the really interesting reportage about this was the discourses by the people on the plane of how they were watching the live television coverage of the disaster in the making, which was the landing of the plane that they were on. It was a super interesting condition of autumn, the production of a spectacle of the live for the live, right? Really interesting and complicated and worth of further exploration. Britain and the proliferation of images, it's a platitude say that in a certain sense it represents the case study of what is about, if it hasn't already happened in the United States, right? The proliferation of cameras itself, a function of a politically exploited social anxiety provoked by terror, et cetera, et cetera. There's a beautiful study that does that, that plays out the case study of Britain for America in a really useful way by a legal theorist, legal cultural critic at Georgetown named Jeffrey Rosen. In a book called The Unwanted Gaze. For those of you who are interested in exploring that, interestingly enough, it's precisely in London, too, for the very reason that you mentioned, that that one of the most advanced experiments in machine vision and the automation of vision from license plate reading to blah, 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 is taking place. That said, the discourse around automated vision and the ability to match a database of faces with cameras that would scan your face when you went into, be it a stadium or an airplane, was one of the great myths of post 9/11 techno assuagery, where precisely any, like, by the way, any kind of smart missile defense systems, the rate of failure was so spectacular that you just cannot imagine how anybody was fooled that this could ever work in any, you know, like, it's astonishing. Not to mention the further detail that even a technology that is comparatively well elaborated and in place in many places, that is retinal scan as a new economy of the biometric, is, as you know, unfortunately not as stable as a fingerprint, because turns out that retinal configurations are somewhat affected by menstruation, which is unfortunate if you happen to be going to the ATM machine while you have your period. This as a bizarre, absurd example of the kind of fallibility of the biometric, but nevertheless, it's, you know, something that ought to give us pause. The question of the cleavage cam, which is shorthand for the phenomenon of bored surveillance operators scoping women, it seems to me, is useful as an example of a displacement onto the erotic of the desire for intelligibility, for, you know, an importation of an economy of intelligibility into a field which, as you absolutely rightly point out, requires an entirely different hermeneutic. And into which, in a similar way, all attempts to sneak in a kind of narrative hermeneutics of eventhood, in a certain sense, are perhaps hideously inappropriate. So it names just a rather simplistic instance of a kind of importation of an economy of rendering intelligible of images that in that regard may well require a kind of scopophilia that is no longer of the order of you know, an erotically driven human, you know, gaze.
So the next question is from Anselm with two microphones.
Sometimes more is more.
Hello, Tom. It's not really a question. It's more like a series of comments.
Oh, good. I can see that.
Asked to explain. Yeah. I've been asked to comment on, or catch up with something that was mentioned yesterday. In an article that just recently appeared on a video that is part of the recent show I have been involved with, as well as Ines, whose work is in the show, called No Matter How Bright the Light, The Crossing Occurs at Night. The video actually kind of remakes a scene from Last Frontier's Kingdom, right, where the main character, forgot her name, is actually trying to get into the hospital and not out of the hospital, which in a way we could kind of see as a paradigm shift, you know, from the disciplinary society or to which the Panopticum, which I haven't seen, because I preferred to see the Duchamp this morning, you could take that as a larger shift, no? Like, so somehow that, you know, to make a long story short, we may find ourselves in a situation where we constantly have to get into what we are already in, right? That kind of, you know, like the whole story, I mean, imagining, which is sometimes nicer than actually going to a site, kind of, which may physically be not so informative if you don't have a very specific question. So imagining that, you know, there's a very kind of almost too obvious argument in your whole kind of performance, including the visit this morning, no? Which is, you know, that which had kind of this this kind of island function is now installed everywhere, producing, as do many other lenses around, a kind of globalized image sphere in which everything that is not kind of able to be captured is simply not there, right? Uh-huh. Doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Now, I thought that what is interesting about that, it's kind of super simplifying story, of course, sure. And could be taken apart in many ways, but what is interesting about that is what you said about claims, right, or what came up kind of between the two of you, kind of what are the criteria or, you know, the history as well of the ability to make claims with images, right? Mm-hmm. And I kind of just wanted to connect that to a phenomena that seems to me very important. It's something that I tried to stress yesterday in turning around a book title of a recent book by published by Doug Aitken, the video artist who's been mm-hmm. covering the whole MoMA facade, mm-hmm. With a kind of image that I would kind of characterize as a non-narrative image which leads to no claim whatsoever, right? Mm-hmm. Or a kind of quality of image production which kind of performs not only the function of an image but as well kind of takes over the function of the imagination, which is exactly what it is fetishized for, which is a certain function, you know, which kind of we could go back to Kant in kind of discussing the transcendental imagination as that what coheres, right? As kind of mm-hmm. opposite to the Verstand, which cuts, right? Mm-hmm. So the kind of cohering function within the image slash imagination which leads to whatsoever claims, right? So that somehow that would be kind of the kind of reactivation of yesterday's claim of turning around that title. I don't know if you came across the book having the subtitle "Expanding the Image, Breaking the Narrative," mm-hmm. or "Breaking the Narrative, Expanding mm-hmm. the Image." I don't mm-hmm. know what's the actual order. Mm-hmm. In which basically Doug Aitken, in a very kind of cool way, appropriates the whole of. As it seems to me, you know, a history of experimental and underground and film and video art, which comes, which really emerges at the moment where the disciplinary regime, kind of with that panopticon, is still in function, and somehow this whole history seems not to have recognized that paradigm shift which you are describing. In a certain way, so that the kind of multi-screen installation immersive environments today kind of precisely lack a recognition of that actual shift.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I know that Sarah Herda had a question. I don't know if you want to use the mic or just speak.
I'm sorry that I have to follow Anne's talk, but I just had a question about. Maybe referred more to some of the things you're discussing earlier with the practice of Nano Jeremy Janko and the kind of someone, an engineer artist who often hijacks all kinds of technologies and re-engineers them. And I guess I was thinking specifically of the Golden Gate Project, which there's no official count of, I mean, maybe people already know this project, but in short, there's no official count of how many people jump off the Golden Gate Bridge each year. And so she has a project where. And this is where it's like, whether it happens or whether it needs to happen or whether it's a fiction, I'm working that way and I'm not clear. But she would insist, I'm sure, that it has happened. She installs a surveillance camera and precisely this issue of proliferation. She writes a code to be able to recognize whether a certain kind of mass is identified, which would be a body, to kind of create a camera where there shouldn't be a camera, creating a count where there isn't an official count. And I was wondering, in a way she's also kind of inciting the imagination of what's possible with surveillance, whether or not it really happens.
I think Jeremy, Natalie's work is a beautiful example of a genre that is all too under explored, which one could call ironic science. And what's so productive about that irony is precisely the undecidability that it provokes. So that, as you nicely say, you know, I work with her and I still am not really quite sure, that inability to actually make a definitive claim about what's at stake requires or demands of the audience, in a certain sense, to ask, well, what is it? What are the criterion by which we ostensibly are more secure in other kinds of similarly presented claims, because of course she uses the rhetoric of a kind of scientific documentary of the project in the video that in a certain sense is the work. So that in that regard, it's a really marvelous mobilization of a mise en scène of a hermeneutics of science that, in its refusal of certain seeming securities, forces one to reflect on that idiom. So, very, very important in that context.
Are there any last questions? Inez, did you have a question?
Because my question might be a bit down to earth, actually, kind of asking what's first, the egg or the hen. And I think that's all implied in this whole concept of surveillance, and you very nicely explained this whole kind of becoming a narrative. And I was just wondering how actually the narrative starts to shape surveillance again. I mean, surveillance becoming a narrative, and what we actually do, how actually the tools at which we are looking, I'm just now maybe looking at this, I don't know the title anymore, but of the guy who was tied to the chair, where actually his friends were, or the friends were watching this. So what was actually done in this film was that, I mean, the tools of surveillance were used, and we were kind of made to laugh about it, or kind of, it was put into a form of a narrative. But I was wondering, what is actually outside? What are we supposed to do? Who is the director? Is this something which is existing in our society already, or is now the director far ahead? Or what you're doing, kind of cultural criticism, are you analyzing the art and the which is produced, or is it actually the society, and where is actually the moment of criticality here?
It's a nice question to end with, if I understand you correctly. To the extent that it asks, in a certain sense, what's at stake in this, these kinds of readings. I'm at the first level trying to catalog a whole set of concerns with certain issues to see how they get treated. Cultural symptomatology, catalog, if you like. To the extent, however, that they then, as you rightly point out, surveillance becomes itself a narrative form, producing subject positions that we can occupy or not, there might well be a tension between ostensible subject matter and structural logics of the film. Simple example, Enemy of the State, whose ostensible politics are very Enlightenment, look how surveillance operates, the wife of Will Smith, the Will Smith character says, well, who's watching the watchers? And it's very progressive, kind of surveillance literate audience producing. And yet, if you begin to do an analysis of the narrative structure of the film's work, you suddenly see that our position is, in fact, exactly that of the NSA, the bad guys whose ability to track everyone, blah, 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 blah. Now, you could say that's a facile point. Nevertheless, there's a tension between the film's ostensible thematic concerns and claims and the structural position in which its narrative the position that the narrative constructs for us. Mm-hmm. And thus, that kind of a structural analysis needs to be part of any kind of attempt to take account of what is at stake in these kinds of treatments of surveillance. Is it about our cultural moment? Sure, and that perhaps it's important to recall what I said at the outset, which is my interest in this, in a sense, as any good Deleuzean would recognize, thoroughly anachronistic paradigm of the panoptic is precisely as a symptomatic displacement. In the same way that the question of the data valent, the non-phenomenal data valence, must be displaced onto something else in order to become visible and thus work through a certain kind of cultural analysis in mass culture, so too the kind of insistence on the panoptic anachronism, whether it's through historical drama a la The Life of the Others or through the seeming updating of a panoptic paradigm through data valence, et cetera, as we have in Enemy of the State. In either case, it's about a rendering visible through strategies of displacement and thus trying to come to terms with the various logics and rhetorics of that displacement, in a certain sense, could be one way of describing what I'm trying to do.
I'd like to actually end at that note, and I'd like to end with a series of expressions of gratitude. Catherine, Surjohn, and I first want to thank Tom Levine for this enormously generous performance, I think it would be the term, and for sharing so much of your time with us. Second, I'd like to thank again the Graham Foundation and Sarah Herda for supporting this conference and the forthcoming publication. And then last but not least, all of you who have spent an enormous amount of time the last 2 days weathering all these nonstop and intense events. I know that many of you from out of town, and some of you are, of course, here from Philly, I hope that you'll come back to Slot Foundation, but also that you'll actually make use of the website. This event, as I've said in the beginning, has been recorded, but there's over 200 hours now of events like this one. And one of the ways that we get the word out is just by spreading the word about those recordings. So hopefully you'll vicariously come back to Slot through the web, but also you'll come back to Philadelphia. So
could I just add, on behalf of the round table, that we would, on behalf of Eyal and all of us, to thank you and Surjohn and Catherine for being such amazing hosts and putting on an absolute feast for these few days. So
we'll
on behalf of
London.
All of us, thank you very, very much.